Coming up, it's Media Matters with Marie Buskey and Marty Gibson, discussing the media through the RCR lens, right here on Reality Check Radio.
Welcome along to Reality Check Radio, here with Marie. It's time now for Media Matters. Media Matters on the road with Marie and Marty. I'm away, Marty. How are you?
Yeah, well, I'm at
home. You're at home.
But I am in a freshly painted home, so just about finished.
Those fingers. How much paint is on those fingers?
Oh, it's pretty,
Yeah, very decorative.
There's a bit. But no, it's a bit like writing, Marie. You know, people say, oh, do you like writing? No, I don't like writing, but I love having written something. and it's a bit like that with painting. I don't enjoy painting particularly, although it is a great opportunity to listen to podcasts. I do love looking at the crispy, beautiful painting that I've done and giving myself a pat on the back. It's like
What have the girls, and when I say the girls, I mean the chooks, what have the girls been saying? Because I'm sure that they've been there in their little coop supervising.
Well, they sort of give you a peck in while you're painting, and that's annoying. I don't know what that – yeah, they sort of do that. I'm not sure what they're trying to tell me. A few of them have got paint on them, but pretty happy. We've actually now – over the weekend broadened our menagerie even more. We've added two guinea pigs to the mix, so 10 chooks, 10 fish, one dog, and two guinea pigs. And I've probably got a few birds nesting in the trees around the place as well. So yeah,
excellent.
We've been having a lot of moaning about the guinea pig for quite a long time, so
I can just imagine who's been doing that. But anyway, let's move on. Well, I'm in Wellington. I'm on the road. Lovely day here in Wellington today.
You can't beat it on a nice day, isn't it?
You can't beat it on a nice day. And I went to the Peter Boghossian event Tuesday night, and it was amazing. It was held at the Cathedral Loaves and Fishes Hall, hosted by the host of the Shape of Dialogue podcast, which is a great up-and-coming podcast, Michael Goldwater, who I interviewed a couple of weeks ago.
Right. Is that a New Zealand-based podcast?
Yeah. He's based in Wellington. He's been doing it for a few years. He started it in 2020, and he's interested in the art of dialogue and preserving the art of dialogue. So him hosting the Wellington event with Peter Boghossian, who's out here with the Free Speech Union, so he hosted Wellington. Of course, Peter wrote a book with James Lindsay called How to Have Impossible Conversations. So he is the master of the art of dialogue.
Right. And is he good at it?
He's very good at it. So he went through discussing how to take – they started – everyone had to do a survey to begin with, and it was asking questions with clips. And the clips had come from – and the questions had been generated from things that they've seen both here in New Zealand and in the media elsewhere that has been said. The engaged people's reactions from strongly agree all the way through to strongly disagree, and then tried to pull people from opposing sides of the question, sort of using techniques and tips and different ideas on how you can actually bridge the gap. So kind of like your zipper consensus, but in reverse.
Yeah. Mm. Well, that's sort of starting, you know, the pyramid as well, which is what Let Kids Be Kids talks about, where the base of our identity really is our common humanity. But for political activists, they want to use the very tip of the pyramid as the base, so ethnicity, gender, sexuality. And the argument is that it creates an unstable identity. Hmm. And it does make it hard to work together if you see each other as a different species, as a lot of Māori leaders seem to indulge themselves in.
Yep. So if you have followed Peter's work and you quite like street epistemology, he's going to do some street epistemology, and it's going to be actually at that cathedral, which is tucked up right behind Parliament. So it's on the concourse there. So if you're sort of in the hood and you want to pop by, and you want to take part in that, we'll just have a little look, and they're going to be doing that on Friday.
Epistemology, what is that? Because I'm very fond of epistemology. So
street epistemology is exactly what we did in the event on Tuesday. So it's taking an idea and finding two people to discuss diametrically opposed concepts of the idea, working through different techniques, Socratic method, to see whether or not you can do that reverse zippa consensus.
Yeah, it's such a good discipline, trying to make an argument for an opposing view. And it's something that we don't do for a reason. It's uncomfortable. Also, we're so sure that we've formed our own opinions when often we haven't. It's exactly. So, you know, that's the stress that you get when you talk to someone who believes the television.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So the nice thing about the meeting is that there were lots of incredible people there. I had dinner with some fantastic women afterwards. You know, when you come away and your cup feels quite full, it was lovely.
I've got to do that a bit more. I've got to travel around a little bit more.
Yeah.
You just don't fly in solo.
Yeah.
Did you drive down?
No, I flew down, flew in. I'm flying in, flying out, heading back after. I'm literally recording you and going straight to the airport. So it's... Right. Yeah, it's good. Hey, now, look, speaking of somebody whose cup might be a little bit empty heading into the festive period, and, I mean, let's face it, he only puts boring stuff in there from what I'm told. Christopher Luxon, he took a bit of a beating this week in one way or another.
A lot of what I was looking at were people sort of ragging on him. And you know, I'm keen to meet him in person because I'm told that in person he's actually quite a lot different, a lot like Helen Clark. You know, I mean, I've met Helen Clark in person. She's very engaging, beautiful eyes, has quite an aura about her. I don't know if Christopher Luxon's necessarily got an aura about it. And it's not a personal thing against him for me. It's the opportunity cost of having the wrong guy in that job. The meat in the path of the tiger, as the Chinese like to describe people who are standing in the way of events and in danger of being overcome by them. He's kept a tight ship in terms of leaks, you know, like this government. I'll have to talk to Cam Slater about this because he'd know, but it doesn't seem to be leaking that much. And I think that's frustrating for the media who normally enjoy white-anting, particularly right-leaning governments.
Yeah, so a number of people had a bit to say. Who do you want to kick off with first? Because I know that you covered more of them than I did. So,
I mean, Brian Bridges was starting to put the acid on Nicola Willis a little bit about why she didn't go harder on cuts and reform, given how hard she campaigned against Labor's bloated bureaucracy and wasteful spending. So he's talking about her delay to the return to surplus again in next week's budget policy statement. So she responded, this is from Ryan Bridges' column, responded predictably saying $23 billion had already been saved in budget 2024 and cutting deeper and faster could jeopardize frontline services and the social safety net. To many on the right, this will sound like a bit of a cop-out given our spending increased 70-odd percent under Labor, and the coalition had only cut public service by 3.3% in the first half of this year to a still high total of 64,537 people. Oh, we've talked about this before, that just the mooing at that 3.3% cut after the 70% growth. It's like a ratchet system, isn't it?
Oh, only yeah.
It's up. Matthew Hooton, I've said before that watching Javier Milei and whatever Vivek Ramaswamy and Elon Musk do is going to make this national government seem even more insipid and Labor light. So Matthew Hooton, you know, was starting to compare what Malay's doing to what Luxon's doing in a column that was entitled Christopher Luxon in Denial About New Zealand's Economy and Sliding Support for His Government. Yeah, he's just saying he's in denial. And Argentina, more often used to warn of the disaster ahead of New Zealand, shows how quickly things can be turned around with sufficient political vision, brains, courage, and leadership at the top.
It's interesting that Hooton has sort of pointed that out, considering where he's come from and where he tends to position himself, because part of the reason Milei has done that is he's taken an absolute chainsaw to the public service, and three quarters of them have been out on their ear.
It takes a certain kind of bravery to do that, and I don't think of brave when I think of Christopher Luxon.
Funny, you should have. I love it when you and I are in sabbatical, because I literally wrote here, not brave, safe, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
I think Luxon's trying to position himself as the safe pair of hands for New Zealand, when actually we don't need a safe pair of hands. We need a bold and courageous pair of hands.
Yeah, we need someone a bit dangerous, don't we? Yeah. And someone who's willing to say, hey, look, we're going to really do something that you might not have seen before, but we've planned it well. We've got a great plan to look after those who fall out, and it's going to be better once we're done. I think New Zealanders would take that a lot better than, well, you know, let's be clear, I'm wealthy and I'm sorted. That's been a real problem for him.
Transitioning on to bold, because of the columns, Cottrell, he took on health. And I think part of that due to the fact that he's had a couple of skirmishes, either himself or people that he knows in recent times in health. Mm. And in his column, which is in the Herald on Weekend Herald, get the cash cart, we've got a health crisis. His article plays directly into the interview that I did with Professor Michael Kingston several weeks ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you haven't heard that interview yet, this is somebody who was actually New Zealand's last superintendent in a hospital at Gisborne Hospital. He's been in public medicine and management and physiatry his entire career. He sees it quite clearly, and he laid it out beautifully. Cottrell has done the same. He's been having a look. Our health system keeps getting worse, not better, despite different governments, restructuring programs, name changes, independent reviews, and health ministers' varying competence and quality. The worse it gets, the lower our expectations become and the lower the standards we are prepared to accept. I had a reminder the other day. A friend of mine had a medical event while in Sydney on business. He thought it might be his heart and managed to get to see a doctor that same morning. He was sent for a scan, which was done immediately. The results were shared with both the doctor and patient that afternoon. He was immediately booked to see a specialist by the end of the day. The same day.
Yeah. The way it should be done.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas contrast that with, at the same time, with a hideously long wait times to see specialists, another mate of mine, this time with a bung hip, waited 4 months to see a specialist. Once there, the specialist spoke to him briefly and ordered a scan. The appointment lasted 4 minutes and cost $375. The patient had asked his GP if he could get a scan before seeing the specialist and was told only the specialist could order it, and then waited a month for the scan and another 2 weeks for the results. The specialist then booked another appointment, this time 2 months out. Now, and that is booking a specialist in private. So you roll at least another 50% time-wise on that for the public system. She broke, Marty.
What? Yeah, without infuriating my wife, you know, as someone who owns part of a medical business that performs a service where there are 2,000 people on the waiting list to get it in the public system, we have the capacity to eat away at a major portion of that waiting list, and we could do it at a fraction of the cost in total of the public system. So, yeah, Stephen Joyce has talked about this. The problem that they've got is that the management of the health system is centered in hospitals, and if you're good at hammering, everything looks like a nail. So they see hospital care as the ultimate epicenter of health, whereas GP care, and he reminisces about this. It wasn't always like this. We once had a health system that was the envy of many countries. At its heart was the local GP, who usually operated out of his own practice and worked long hours at the clinic, often from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. The same doctor would then do house calls on his or her way home in the evening if required. They knew their patients, their families, and their state of health. Since then, the corporatization of doctors' clinics has changed the way our health is serviced. These corporate-style GP operations are based in bigger premises and have a number of doctors on their roster. None of these doctors are owner-operators. Some will work full-time, while others are part-time. Most work from 9 a.m. through to 5 p.m. Very few make house calls. And, you know, the thing that he's been too – doesn't want a war on fronts, or two fronts, obviously, but the increasing number of women in healthcare – as doctors has been a major driver of this, because they're not as tolerant of a deeply, deeply unbalanced way of living. And I grew up with that. My old man, GP, sometimes worked 80 hours a day and would blow.
80 hours a week, rather.
Yes, sorry. And he'd blow in like a leaf at the end of the day. And the only thing you could say to him was, do you want a beer, Dad? That was it. And then dinners would be these frosty, tense things because he'd seen all this horrific shit. My wife worked as a general practitioner when she first came to New Zealand. She worked for my dad, which is how I met her. The saying that they had at the end of the day was, it's like gang rape. Pretty poor-taste joke, but there's that feeling that everything was just getting sucked out of you.
He alluded, the following paragraph, Cottrell says, I know a young doctor who's recently entered public practice working as a GP for one of those services. She now works 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. 4 days a week. She's quite happy with that workload.
Yeah.
And where do you find the balance?
Talking about the gender wage gap.
Well, where do you find that balance? And, you know, it's funny, gender wage, you bring that up.
Well, where do you find that lack of balance is the question.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. So after the talk on Tuesday night, I went out for dinner with some fantastic women. The gender wage gap came up in conversation. It was so refreshing to talk to women who were completely awake to this. You know, they were awake to the fact that as women, yes, we want to be paid for what we're worth, but also too, we need to accept to be paid that equivalent amount. Are we also prepared to make the social sacrifices that our male counterparts will be making in order to earn the same amount of money? For a lot of women, the answer to that is no. They want to have all the social sacrifices. They want to have all the social padding and flexibility, but still be paid the same amount. So it's like, well,
the elephant in the room is that most women want to be with a man who earns more than them as well. As I've often said, I'm the E in the LGBT. I'm an economic transsexual. And women hate it. My wife would much rather I earned more than her. It comes with a raft of biological reflexes that aren't factored in. I should make a submission to the Ministry for Women. I'm doing my bit, ladies, but you hate it.
Further on in the article, he talks about bonding. And when we say bonding, we're not talking the leather strap-on kind here and little funny shades of grey red rooms. No, we're talking bonding with something. And Marty and I probably remember this from when we were kids. It's something when you were a kid, particularly in a rural area like where I grew up and Marty's family are from, is that if you got a doctor in that area, the only way you got was a bonded doctor. And they were usually doctors that had come out from the United Kingdom or were trained through the United Kingdom system. They wanted to immigrate to New Zealand. But in order to do that, they were bonded to these tiny little backwater places as GPs in those areas. And I think the bonds lasted 2 years from memory. There may have been five, but I think they were 2 years. All the doctors I remember as a child seeing in this tiny little village in the back of bum F nowhere where I grew up.
Wash your mouth out. Do not speak about Matawai that way.
I know, but you cannot argue with the fact that it's in the middle of nowhere. It's on the road, it is. And all the doctors were British or British trained, and they lasted for a few years. And if you were lucky, once they came off bond, they actually stayed in the area. So you still had the option to go to town to see them because they all moved into Gisborne. They didn't stay out in Matawai. And here he is. Here's Cottrell suggesting the bondage system again as a way to keep some of these doctors, particularly with the number of foreign medical students that are coming that then eventually head off back overseas, or as a way to lure some of these doctors that are coming in, these refugees from elsewhere, other medical systems, to actually get them to the places that we need them, because most of them arrive and go into our larger centres. They actually don't go into rural practices like Murupara, like Matawai, like Matawhero. They don't go to places like that.
Yeah, well, my wife just wanted to get away from the UK. It was raining and she was on a break at a hospital and she read an ad that my old man had written, and I later wrote ads attracting doctors from the UK. And yeah, she flew into Gisborne and just saw how tiny it was. And the second time she came, I actually invited her out I was through working at the paper and I was going to a Country Women's Institute meeting. And I said, I've been invited to a dinner tonight. It was sort of like a potluck dinner. and she dressed right up, had this faux fur coat and everything. And there were all these country institute ladies who I love. I'm very fond of their pet reporter. They used to get me to do all this stuff. But it was quite a shock. And it was, you know, only through me marrying her and having kids with her that I managed to secure her as a permanent doctor for New Zealand. So,
go on, be honest. That ad that was placed by your dad said, secure a job in sunny Gisborne and a husband. Go on, be honest. That's what it must have said.
He actually, when we first met, he hadn't told her about me at all, because I'd expressed an interest in him, because Gisborne's a miserable place to be if you're single. Oh, it's awful, especially if you've just come from Sydney and London. It's pretty grim. And, yeah, he was very resistant to my questioning about whether she was pretty or not. And I met her and said, oh, she is actually really nice to look at. And I said to my father, look, you've been holding out on me, Dad. You know, like, why didn't you mention that? And he just started jabbing his finger into my chest and saying, if you upset her and she goes back to the UK and I can't get to go to Australia to see my grandchildren, I'm going to be very unhappy with you, boy. Which was a red rag to a bull.
Yes, I could well imagine. Further on, and we'll continue with the article. Recently, we learned of 844 of 1,619 nursing graduates were offered jobs. That means that 775 missed out. What he's referring to there are the DHB jobs, because usually most of these nursing graduates go into DHB. Now, earlier in the article, he cited, according to Health New Zealand, we have 1,817 nursing vacancies at the end of 2023. Now, joining the dots and the gaps and what isn't there is that a lot of these graduates want to go into DHB setting. That's generally where they're trained. That's where they want to go. Where a lot of these vacancies are actually in aged care. And he went on further and he said, most of us understand that we have an ageing population that will only become more needy in the next 20 years. That's right, Bruce. We do. And it's sad because in the aged care scenario, they're screaming for nurses and they can't get them.
And if you had management really doing what it should be doing, which is coordinating your workforce, aged care is quite a good place to train nurses. And I think the reason that they freak out about it is that they think, well, once I'm in there, I'm going to get stuck in there. But, you know, you're dealing with a lot of multiple systems failures, and it's a good teaching opportunity. So if you, if you had a dynamic management rather than, one that was schooled in the various bits of woke, you might use that to your advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, the following paragraph in this article was the one that really was the eye-opener for me. I recently watched a speech given by an Australian doctor and medical professor speaking about the likely downstream impacts on health as a result of the rushed COVID vaccination scheme. If what he is saying is accurate, then we're going to have an even greater pressure on our health system over the next 20 years than historical evidence might suggest. Now, putting two and two together, I think he has seen...
He's going right up the edge there, isn't he?
He is. I think he's seen the video circulating of the speech given by Professor Ian Brighthope from Western Australia. And if that is what he's referring to, and I think he alludes there that it could be, that and the fact that A, he's watched that, and B, he's referenced it in his column, is something we would not have seen even 6 months ago.
It's disgusting that we're not. Let's be quite clear about that. This part of my major problem with reading, consuming the media is those ignoring the elephant in the rooms thing. And it's also a problem politically, because if politicians aren't confronting, this turbo cancer and these immunological issues that people are facing, and a raft of issues, strokes and the resulting neurodegenerative issues, if we're not even admitting that yet, even though the data's there, the problem's going to deepen, isn't it?
Well, we didn't cover it last week, but I know I read it. Did you see the article in last weekend's paper about the 26-year-old woman who kept complaining of sort of neurological pain and the like, and kept going back and back to the doctor, and they kept basically brushing her off as it was all in your head, love. Yeah. And then finally she gets seen, she gets scanned, and she's now got stage 4 cancer. And it's such a rare cancer, something almost never seen in women of that age.
Marches to stage 4 is quite a new thing.
Yeah. And this is where we're at now, because of course the medical fraternity need to catch up, because, and this is what, if you watch the Bright Hope speech, is that these cancers, as you said, the march from sort of right up to terminal level, which is level 4, that's only going to rapidly increase. The time frames that you're used to dealing with are now out the window. You can't, if you're boosted and beyond, you can't actually use the standard diagnostic criteria for those
Professor
time frames.
Professor Angus Dalgleish, like, if you're interested in this at all, go back and listen to some of the interviews I think Paul Brennan did with Professor Dalgleish. When you listen to it, you think, well, it's so beautifully curated, the information. It's so meticulously referenced and glazed in solid data that's out there. The Ministry of Health know it.
And there's this old sort of adage in medicine, right? You know, if you hear hoofprints, if you hear hoofbeats, you need to look for donkeys or horses, because that's probably what it is. Well, now
I've never heard that before in my life.
Well, with COVID vaccination now, because they'll often say to young doctors, don't go off trying to find zebras because it's never the zebras. Well, I can tell you now, you've been injecting people with something that makes zebras, and there are zebras left, right, and centre. So you're getting young women like this 26-year-old woman being diagnosed with a cancer that you never see in someone her age, rapidly progressing. Doctors are going to have to catch up. The reality of it is you've put needles in all these arms, you're going to start seeing all this weird shit. And are they going to catch up? Because then if they have to catch up, they have to admit that this is actually going on and happening.
Well, and the sooner they do that, the better. Because, I mean, it's very much like the young people reporting with symptoms of myocarditis. They knew that that was a possible side effect. But rather than telling doctors, watch out for this, it is a possibility. And if you see it, respond to it swiftly and appropriately to minimize ongoing damage. Rather than doing that, all those doctors have been threatened by Comrade Cindy, by Ashley Bloomfield, by Christopher Hipkins. And as a consequence, they told them it was anxiety. It was all in their heads. It was very much a magnification of the nefariousness, wasn't it? Not only were you subjecting people to this damage, you were then gaslighting them when they suffered it, and not giving them the appropriate timely help they needed to minimize the damage from it.
Yeah, we're going to go into that a little later on before we head off for the morning. But and just staying with Christopher Luxon and some of the things that he's got to juggle, I do know, because of course it's scrutiny week. It's been scrutiny week, so they're supposed, it doesn't seem to be a lot of scrutiny that goes on. But the other thing that does concern me is this genetic modification bill. It's funny how they seem to introduce these bills right before Christmas when things get rushed through. Like,
well,
let's get this rushed through because it's Christmas.
Why it's getting rushed through. Let's just be open and honest about why it's getting rushed through. It's getting rushed through because idiots like James Shaw wanted to put agriculture in New Zealand's Paris Accord commitments, despite the fact that food production was exempt and we could have gotten away with not doing it, but because they wanted to demonstrate that New Zealand was committed, blah, blah, blah. And so the reason we're suddenly rushing through and becoming, by many accounts, one of the least regulated environments for genetic modification in the world is so we can give our cows these boluses to prevent methane. And it's just so muddle-headed. We're entering this incredibly dangerous period, which is not dissimilar to the gene therapy that was rebranded as a vaccine, so people accepted it. The only reason we're doing that is because we've got a $30 billion liability from this climate tomfoolery. And, you know, they're saying, oh, agriculture's now out of the emissions trading scheme. It's still in our liabilities because Mr. Swollen Parotid Glands included it there.
Ridiculous. Did you catch the interview with Paul? Was it the end of last week, earlier this week, with Kerry Worsnop around?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Greenwashed has been fantastic about all this. I was listening to their show. I can't recall off the top of my head who they were talking to, but it was someone who was involved in the methane, the organization lobbying government that methane wasn't the big deal that they said it was. And they were talking about how flimsy the science was about including it there. It's got such a short life, and it comes out of recombination of existing CO2.
Mm-hmm. Marty, flimsy science, you're onto something there, because look at the damage that has been wrought both in the environmental space and also in the culture space, and I'm thinking gender medicine, and COVID, God, all on the basis of flimsy science.
Yeah, and again, we've got the meat in the path of the tiger in Christopher Luxon. He's an avid globalist, so he'll say things like, yes, well, and we'll arrest the Israeli prime minister, you know, because what, a good boy would say that? I'm a good boy, I'll say that. Oh, we're absolutely fixated on net zero by 2050. Christopher, it's not a practical thing, and, you know, there are much better things you could do for New Zealand's environment. You know, why be beholden to some globalist anti-human? Oh, gosh.
You're getting a bit randy. Now, just before we jump off Christopher Luxon, because it's a little bit more oblique, and because I do want to talk about Mike Benz, is Shane DePoe. I fully agreed with Shane's column this week.
Yeah, kia ora, Shane.
Yeah, kia ora for that, Shane. Shane DePoe has been trying to get himself a interview with the Solicitor General. Solicitor General?
Yeah.
No, sorry. Yes. Solicitor General.
Solicitor General Una Jaguas.
Yes. So he's been trying to get an interview with them and around, because of course they delivered the apology for the abuse in state care. But then they've been rather difficult to get hold of. And as Shane said here, at every stage of the back and forth between myself and the Solicitor General's PR team, the Wellington bureaucracy has done everything in its power to prevent the interview from taking place. They've claimed that the Solicitor General has given her speech an apology and there was no need to engage with Māori media because those speeches are available online. And if a one and done statement suffices for all the harm done. And this is the thing with this apology. I've got an interview coming up. It's going to go straight out direct. I've done it. I just need to tidy it up. It's going to go straight direct out into On Demand. And that is a follow-up with Melissa Davies, which we've been covering about her experiences of the abuse with state care in Oranga Tamariki, and Mike Ferris from the Citizens Commission on Human Rights. Now, Mike, he's been involved with this organisation for a number of years. They were the ones that were at the heart of the Lake Alice case. So they do some tremendous work in this space. The interview is fantastic, so look out for it. It'll probably drop next week. And good on you, Shane, because he's essentially citing that a lot of these abuses are not being investigated, looked into, due to the cost incurred by the Crown. So therefore, they just let these people suffer.
Yeah, not only the cost, but the fact that if you're going to pay compensation, you're going to be paying it to people who've gone on following their abuse to be, you know, undesirables in society. Surprise, surprise. And you know, I mean, certainly survivors have speculated about being essentially, as children, prostituted out to well-dressed people. For me, that's the thing that I really want assurance that has been not only looked at but ensured it doesn't happen anymore. Because one of those things that is very difficult for people to, well, think about, because it's awful to think about, is that these people who are doing things that are not in the interests of our country and are, on the face of it, unpopular and stupid, the fact that around the world they're often maintained in that state of doing that through sexual bribery. That's where Jeffrey Epstein was operating. That's where
Jay-Z, they're all getting pulled into it now.
It's ugly, ugly thing. It's incomprehensible to normal people who, you know, for whom that even the thought of it is repugnant. But we have to have a hypothesis. Did this happen in New Zealand's past? Was it used to maintain various orthodoxies? Were these children used as bait in a honey trap? Mm-hmm. And is that, furthermore, is that a reason the government has been so dragging its feet on fixing it?
Well, definitely in terms of the prostitution element, that is something that I cover with Mike in the interview. So you did.
Is that right?
Yes. Ooh. Yes.
What so you,
think? It's occurring. Yeah. You've got girls, young women, and actually boys too, who are in group homes or state care, who are supplementing their income with prostitution, either fully unsupervised or there is an awareness, but nothing is done.
Mm.
Pretty much. That's paraphrasing, but pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, You know, something I've said before is it's a shame that the terrible consequences of, say, orphanages or state care facilities for children attracted pedophiles, attracted sadists, attracted psychopaths. We have to overcome our repugnance at that and re-envisage how those facilities might happen without the psychopaths and deviants, because they're needed in some ways. You know, I've often been interested in what would a self-referral system for children look like. So if a child said, hey, look, I'm not safe in the environment I'm in, and you can have them trust that, okay, well, you can go to a place where you are safe and regroup, and we can, you know, address what's been happening to you, and you won't be further harmed.
Mm.
You know, compassionate society would have that capability.
Yeah, they would. And what really makes me angry with what's gone on with this commission of inquiry, they've had this apology, which to me at this stage is just lip service. All these recommendations, Mike goes into this, so I'm not going to let too much of a cat out of the bag there. You need to definitely listen to that interview, because there are groups out there doing some amazing work, okay, in the space. And I spoke to Jared Van Urkel about his documentary Manu Atua, which he is doing with a guy called, oh, it was Lucky Takani, I think his name was, and he's working, going into these gangs, talking to these young gang members who most of them have been abused in state care.
Yeah, so, most of them.
Most of them, more than 80%. So you've got that pathway there. But I tell you what, the states certainly aren't going to save them, because it's even worse there.
Yeah, I mean, it all comes back to that problem where governments love anything that makes people demand less freedom and more government.
Mm.
And so us having psychopaths and you know, people with personality disorders wandering around unchecked, and in many cases, you know, they don't just fail to pull the weeds, they fertilize them in terms of paying women to have multiple kids with psychos. Again, it's like the COVID side effects, the vaccine side effects. You've got to be aware, hey, this is going to happen. There are going to be these people. And if we don't have a process to kind of weed them out, and if we don't have, in some ways, a way of recognizing people who are healthy and who are good people, again, it brings some uncomfortable possibilities in terms of different standards of citizenship. But I think we almost need them. And you know, I've said to the school before, you know, why don't we get all the fathers who passed the police vetting test, and we'll get together and do something.
Mm. Mm. Now, I want to talk about, and you're quite right, and I want to talk about, before we go, because we've got a bit of feedback too, is both you and I listened to the recent Joe Rogan podcast with Mike Benz. Mike's been on the station several times. He is the clearest voice when it comes to the censorship web, the octopus, as he called it, of the blob.
The blob, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2.5 hours I'm going to have to re-listen to, because there was so much there.
Yeah.
But it also shows that no country is immune to this. And a lot of it has come out of the US, but how that the blob has been able to disseminate messaging via these either directly governmental type organisations and or the NGOs themselves, to get messaging out all the way through it's the timeline that intrigues me. Like, as you said, a lot of the foundations were there, but the election of Trump in 2016 created an imperative to these blobbies that they needed to create something. And then COVID, you know, they literally went completely unchecked and COVID put it on steroids for years. What stood out for you? Like, when you, did you, what were, did you, I had multiple aha moments, but what were your big aha moments?
Oh, well, you know, I've only listened to that particular interview in a patchy way, but I've listened to so many Mike Benz arguments. I mean, the big takeaway from what Mike Benz generally says is that the misinformation thing, it is a product of the blob. They've got AI involved in controlling algorithms. They've got backdoors to every social media company except X, and they... getting rid of X isn't a want to have, it's a need to have for them at this stage. So, you know, we're really seeing that there's a lot going on that's not covered in the media, which is what makes it so frustrating. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we're sort of seeing the coverage of Syria. We're not seeing, oh, well, it's a proxy part of World War III that's going on. You know, it's just, oh, yeah, Syria, the rebels, yeah, taking Damascus. Oh.
Yay, the rebels. And I'm like,
a million people dead. Woohoo, yeah, small price to pay. All the stuff which objectively is just ghastly, and a ghastly failure to acknowledge the terrible waste of human life. And beyond that, a lot of disability and awfulness.
Well, and Ben's actually, particularly Ukraine, towards the end of the interview, he actually touched on a lot of the dynamics with that conflict that you will never hear.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
we spend so much time arguing against people who believe the television. It's the hardest thing. It's like, dude, I watch the TV too. Okay. I know what your opinion is because I've watched your opinion on TV, but you need to cast your net a little bit wider.
Yeah. And there are things like, you know, the Disinformation Project, thank goodness that has now been dissolved. But it showed how that was not a new idea. That was something that's been rolled out across all that Western canon. I mean, so they just followed suit here.
In an academic sense. And guess where Delia's gone? Because she's, you know, she's someone who was identified as having a friendly, believable disposition. That women would think, oh, she's not going to hurt me. She's kind.
Mm.
But she's gone to crush free speech. And, I mean, that was the Christchurch call. And the idea that it's come from her is hopelessly naive. You know, she's very much a puppet in all of this. And when you see the network that's driving this and how it works – that's the most sinister thing. You know, she's been enlisted by these people who want to severely curtail freedom of speech and want to control humanity.
There was an app that they talked about right at the very end, which I think it was called Squint. Anyway, right. it was this app, and it was an app that was developed, and they were encouraging people to download it. And what you could do is you could go to social media. It was designed, and again, it's designed by an agency that has been funded by the US government. If you saw anything on social media, if you opened that in the app, it automatically took a screenshot, sent it to the app developers that then ran their analytics over, would look at it, essentially get it shut down off social media, and then use that information to compile a database to feed an AI to go back through all social media and crawl through and shadow ban and block any content that they don't want. And they started it with democracy, to firm up maintaining democracy and stop Trump in 2016. But then, oh, you know, COVID was the cash cow that kept on giving. Yeah. And away they went. And
remember, they war-gamed COVID. They war-gamed COVID in about 21 different occasions. The challenge in these war-gamings wasn't to ensure people's basic health was improved so they're more resistant to a pandemic. The war-gaming was about how to get Western democracies to pivot to being dictatorships by co-opting the media and social media companies.
Mm.
And that's what they did.
Yep, and the nudging that they, and it's more than nudging actually. It was more than nudging in some of the cases. It was fair on, right on bulldozing. Absolutely. It is. So if you haven't had a chance to catch up with that interview, it is. I mean, whenever I hear anything done by Ben's, my little brain just completely melts down.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, something that I felt bad about in my various media matters and political panels that I haven't mentioned is how disappointed I am in Mahi Drysdale for being such a coward about the fluoridation of Tauranga's water. And, you know, if we're talking to our listeners now, I would say, you know, something we all have to do more is go and see our elected representatives and try and get some steel in their spines.
Oh, they were going to give us a fine.
Yeah, mate, like, stand up straight.
And what you do, Mahi, is you don't pay it. You don't pay it, Mahi. You don't pay it, and you say, no, because this is unlawful. No. Yeah.
We're seeing some research out of America that suggests that it does cause an IQ drop, and you know we don't want to be judged harshly by history as having done something stupid. So, you know, if you can prove to our satisfaction that it is as efficacious as you so firmly seem to believe, then well and good. But as I've said before, the days of trust me, I'm an expert, gone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the more of these councils, I mean, Whangarei we know has already had the vote. And I think, was there somewhere in Horowhenua, and I know Nelson is, I think there's one that's just lost. But if you've got more and more people standing up, more people standing up and saying no, more of these councils standing up and saying no, either we want more time or just a flat out no.
Yeah, show me.
Yeah, then the government will be forced to look into this, because at this stage, I think the local government minister, so who's that? Who is the local? Is it Bishop, the local government minister? They are just, it's in the, oh no, that's a decision we don't want to take. Simeon Brown is it. Yeah, there you go. They need to realise that there are wider issues and implications here. Surely, after the COVID debacle, where you're actually forcing people to take something, this is forced medication in one form or another. If people are wanting to continue with that, they can actually have, they can supplement with fluoride. That is possible. You can do that. If that's what you want to do. That's what you want to do. Great. But the thing is this whole putting things in there for the whole greater good. Oh, that was the other thing with the Benz thing, wasn't it? The whole of society. Remember, there was an entire thread that they had with these think tanks to create this mindset of the whole of society, which is the new greater good. But fluoride falls into this. This arguments don't wash anymore. Anyway, I promised myself I wasn't going to get ranty. Stop me from getting ranty.
You even moaned at me for being ranty, which was, I thought was a sure sign that maybe I was being too ranty.
No, I know. Hey, Nod, we have had some fantastic feedback. We have had some. We love your feedback, guys. Keep it coming.
Yeah, no, it's been some real heartening stuff, hasn't it? Thank you so much for that.
So 2057 is the text. Inbox at realitycheck.radio is the email. From Janet in Mochaweka, thanks, Marty and Marie. I've listened to your latest show twice in as many days. The second, better, funnier, and even more informative. And it was the same show. Such is the advantages of old age. I very much...
You're always meeting new people. You get to wrap your own Christmas presents and you get to wrap your own Christmas presents.
I very much enjoyed listening to you two chew the fat over the year, and I'm so glad for you to hear that you'll have a well-deserved summer detox is almost here. We'll miss you. Have a great time. Best wishes from Janet. Thank you, Janet. And we are looking very much forward to our summer detox. Next week we're going to do, we're going to be back actually on Wednesday next week. As for the final show for the year, and we're going to have a little bit of a reminisce, aren't we, Marty? We're going to have a reminisce about the year.
It's been an interesting time. I mean, you know, we're pretty open about things, which I think is probably, you know, what makes it somewhat different from news, which necessarily, because it costs so much to put on a TV program, is a bit different. But I've threatened to write columns for a long time, and Alia and Claire are always, you know, threatening to use AI to gather what I say to write columns for me. But yeah, I'm going to do that over the summer a bit and sort of step out of digesting news and sort of come up with some theoretical stuff for you to chew over, but it's pretty straightforward. It's the old observe nature and copy it stuff.
Here's an idea for you.
Go on.
While you're painting your house, just put the voice recorder on and just start dictating a whole bunch of stuff. And then you can spit it out. Because I know you sit things ruminate. You're a ruminator, Marty.
Yeah.
And I know what you'll be like on that roller. You'll be ruminating about this and that. Just spit it all out and then you can, you know, transcribe it and away you go. There you go. Okay. Excellent show. Thank you. Thank you guys for that. Hi guys. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Just the best program on radio, always on point, always concise, always a laugh too. And if we can't get a laugh at the absurdity in the world, we're all doomed. Keep it up, team. The world needs your inputs and long live the pipe dream of the Marty Party. Go well into 2025, Stu from Fodda Fodda. Thanks, Stu.
Thanks, Stu. Yeah, I don't know about concise.
Emily and Marie, your discussion of Luxon was good. Oh, gosh, you're going to like this week even more then. No spine. Next election will be a challenge. Support for ACT in New Zealand First will be up. But will it be enough to rule without the remnants of National? Hopefully the Greens will lose their last list MP. Maybe a concerted effort by New Zealand First and Auckland Central will catch the Greenies in Waiheke and unseat Chloe Swishbag and an entire Green Rainbow Party. Māori seats, racist in brackets, and a push for Māori to go on racist electoral role was employed by Tamahere with the hikoi. He should be dealt to for his electoral tampering last election. It will be a riveting time. Sorry for the rant, Kingsley. Kingsley, my friend, you're amongst
you've come to the right place.
You've come to the right place, indeed. From Grant, Luxon is indeed letting ACT and New Zealand First take the heat from an active National Party member in Auckland, Chairs Grant. And, you know, he came up again over dinner conversation with the people at this meeting the other night. And, yeah, a lot of people are turning away from National and looking at those coalition partners as their options if they're wanting something on that side of the fence. Marty, I find myself falling a little bit more in like with you each week. Ooh, Mrs. Marty might have some competition, particularly when you do all the Helen Clark impersonations. Gold. And Marie, you're just amazing. Love, love, love your show. Merry Christmas from Annie. There you go, Marty. Oh,
maybe you get the love and I get the like, eh? Well, I'll take it, Annie.
Rehear the Duplessis Ellen, her husband Barry Soper has a serious heart issues recognised in the post-jab effect. Further, she's away from work this week after proudly announcing jabbing her baby and herself up. I kid you not, RCR, could you please send the best jab discussion book, Turtles All the Way Down, best Christmas book ever, folks. Keep your bloodlines healthy. No, right.
That's
a good suggestion. Hi, M&Ms. Your insightful banter is the RCR highlight of my week. Oh, thank you. Relax and comment to me, it seems clear signalling to the Davos crowd. Well, you have said that, haven't you, Marty? Even though I personally do think Netanyahu is a war criminal, how's that for the broad view of things? The Israel issue, clever manipulation to drive a divide in a so-called freedom movement. Yeah, it is very much a contentious issue. And yeah, we stay away from it because we're no experts in it. That's why we don't discuss it. It's as simple as that.
My interest is in stopping New Zealand becoming the Middle East.
The idea in Trump's tariff plan is to reduce in part or wholly income tax, just like it was in the early last century. However, back then, the federal government welfare programs were almost non-existent, not to mention corporate welfare and the offence budget. So it won't work, cheers, David. Did you see the article, actually, that was on the Trump tariffs written by the AUT Professor of Economics?
No.
It was interesting. He wasn't quite so phased about it, but there was lots of kind of elastic modelling with numbers. And I have to admit, when I start seeing that, I'm thinking, yeah, the minute you start modelling anything, I'm like, teh, I tune out.
But especially with the headline, right?
Marie and Marty, great show this morning and interesting to hear your views again. Working in the hearing health sector for over 40 years, most DNAs always in the public sector, 30%. Second was third-party payment, 20%. And finally, when wins clients, it's 15%. In private sector with no subsidies, less than 1%. More importantly, the latter category is about 100% higher effective treatment outcomes. Funny that. Regards and thanks again from Alan. And gosh, you know, when you don't pay for something, you tend not to value it.
Yeah, it's amazing. If I've said before, if you've got a business, anytime you do a prize or something and someone gets something for free, it just always turns into a massive ball ache. I don't know how they do it.
No, me neither.
It's human nature, isn't it? And it's, we almost need to get back toward human nature and government. And I don't know. I mean, maybe we're on the brink of that. I think the appetite's building for it. But it's just the challenge is to have the resoluteness that you can get when you've got one person running the show without the death camps. And I created a system with the working title of nano-fascism, which postulated that if you scaled back that as little as possible, so interpersonal relationships buffered that coldness if you're just dealing with people as numbers, you could do it. And that allows, again, I mean, I always go to that Swiss system.
Canton.
Yeah, the Canton system, a way of getting different people to live. And, you know, the irony is that's true diversity, because the diversity we're being sold is, okay, you've got to sprinkle everything you do with Maori and then you all be the same. You'd be a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And it's like, that's not diversity. I'd love to see a place maybe in the Uruwera where Maori can live authentically as they want. But the problem is that the leaders are thinking, well, we want everything. It's this quixotic battle for everything. But I've said this to the Greens before as well. Get one village where you try out your shit.
Mm.
See how it works. Let's have a foot race.
Well, you know, I'm in Central Wellington at the moment, and judging by the complaints and moans and groans from people I've heard down here, and, you know, Green MP, Green Mayor, well,
give
I don't
the
think the Wellington
Central
experiment
Wellington
is working.
What they want. Give them their refugees.
Well, on that note, we will see you again next week on a Wednesday next week, so Wednesday at 10 o'clock. So for the final show of the year, where Marty and I will ruminate across all the different things that we've discussed across the year. We'll take as big the ultimate 2024 Zoom out. I'll look forward to that, Marty. Thank you for everyone that's contributed. 2057 is the text number. Inbox at realitycheck.radio is the email, and we'll do it again one last time next week.
Hey, you know, before we go, something I've been meaning to say as well is, hey, please do send in newspaper articles or, you know, things from the media that you'd like us to look at. You know, probably a bit late in asking for that, but that'd be great as well. You know,
yeah, work on that for you.
We're scanning through and, you know, we look at what we're looking at, but we're always interested in hearing what's striking you as queer.
Perfect. Excellent. And on that note, we'll do it all again one last time next week. Thanks, Marty.
Thanks, have a safe trip home and have a great week, everyone.
If you've been told to pull up your socks recently, then make sure it's a pair of RCR socks. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.